If you've ever been standing on a flight line when a Merlin engine fires up somewhere in the distance, you know exactly what I'm talking about. That sound stops you cold. Doesn't matter what you're doing or who you're talking to, it goes right into your chest and stays there. You don't explain it later. You just carry it with you. I'm Tail Dragger on Radio Hangar, and today we are going back to March 5, 1936, to a cold, wet grass aerodrome near Southampton, England. A test pilot named Captain Joseph Summers climbed into a narrow cockpit, ran up an engine nobody had really heard in anger before, and lifted off into the gray English winter sky. 8 minutes later, he put it back on the grass, climbed out, and said four words that would echo for the rest of the century. He said, "I don't want anything touched." That airplane was prototype K5054. We know it today as the Supermarine Spitfire, and the man who designed it was already dying. Pull up a chair. This is a story about genius and stubbornness, and about what one engineer's refusal to quit meant for the whole free world. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Reginald Joseph Mitchell was born in 1895 in Staffordshire, England, the son of a schoolteacher. He was the kind of boy who couldn't leave mechanical things alone. He built model aircraft as a teenager, and at 16 he was apprenticed to a locomotive engineering firm. But engines were in his blood, in a way that went beyond trains. And when the First World War blew open the aviation industry the way it did, Mitchell found his way to Southampton and to a company called Supermarine Aviation Works. He joined as an apprentice. Within 3 years he was chief designer. He was 24 years old. The kind of talent that makes other engineers stand up a little straighter when he walks into the room. His early work at Supermarine was in flying boats and utility seaplanes. Practical aircraft, workhorses, the kind that don't make the history books. But then came the Schneider Trophy, and everything changed. The Schneider Trophy was in the 1920s, the Formula One of aviation. An international seaplane race run over a closed course, where national pride and enormous engineering budgets crashed up against the absolute limits of what was aerodynamically possible. Countries sent their best engineers, their best pilots, and the speeds being flown were extraordinary by the standards of the day. Mitchell designed a series of racers for Supermarine that simply dismantled the competition. In 1927, his S5 won at 281 miles per hour. 2 years later, the US-6 pushed the record to 328. In 1931, with the British government threatening to pull its funding entirely, a private citizen, Lady Lucy Houston, donated £100,000 to keep the program alive. Mitchell's S6B crossed the finish line at over 340 miles per hour. Three consecutive wins meant Britain kept the trophy permanently. But here's what those racing seaplanes really were. They were a laboratory. Every lesson learned about high-speed aerodynamics, about cooling systems under extreme conditions, about how a propeller behaves when it is trying to drag an airframe through the air at 340 miles per hour. Every one of those lessons went directly into Mitchell's brain. Rolls-Royce was working alongside him, pushing their engines to speeds and power outputs nobody had ever asked them for before. The knowledge being accumulated in that racing program was going to matter far more than anyone realized at the time. In the early 1930s, Mitchell was diagnosed with cancer. He traveled to Germany for surgery and treatment, and while he was there, he attended an air show. He watched the new generation of German military aircraft. He came back to England quieter than he'd left, and he told his team at Supermarine that they needed to build a fighter unlike anything the Royal Air Force currently had, because war was coming, and Britain was not ready. His doctor told him to rest. He went back to his drawing board. Now here's where it gets interesting. Mitchell's first attempt at a modern fighter, the Type 224, flew in 1934 and was not a success. It was underpowered, sluggish, and handled like a loaded truck. Mitchell knew it. The Air Ministry knew it. And Mitchell, who was not a man to accept a mediocre result, scrapped the approach almost entirely and started over. He called the new design the Type 300. We call it the Spitfire. He reportedly hated the name. When they told him what they were calling it, he said it was a bloody silly name. It stuck anyway. The thing that made the Spitfire genuinely revolutionary was not immediately obvious from the outside. Everybody notices the graceful lines, the long nose, the elegant proportions. What they sometimes miss is the wing. The Spitfire wing is elliptical from above. It has an almost oval shape, narrowing smoothly toward the wingtip in a gradual curve rather than a straight taper. It is, without argument, one of the most beautiful wings ever mounted on an airplane. It was also extraordinarily difficult to build. The curves required careful hand-fitting by skilled craftsmen at a time when everyone else was moving towards straight-line mass production. Mitchell's team was deliberately making things harder for themselves, and there was a very good reason. A high-speed fighter needs thin wings to reduce drag at speed, but thin wings do not leave you room for retractable landing gear, for guns, for the belts of ammunition those guns need. And a wing that is too thin loses lift at low speed, which pushes your takeoff and landing speeds into dangerous territory. The elliptical planform solved all three problems simultaneously. It distributed lift evenly across the full span, which meant the wing could be thinner overall, while still generating enough lift at manageable approach speeds. It minimized induced drag at high speed. And because the cord, the front-to-back depth of the wing was widest in the middle section, there was just enough room to pack in the retracted main gear legs and the gun bays. The result was an airplane that felt alive in the hands at high speed, in a way that other fighters simply did not. Spitfire pilots talked about it for years and decades afterward. Not twitchy, not heavy, responsive. Like it was reading your intentions before you moved the stick. Like it genuinely wanted to fly.
Captain Mutt Summers made the first flight of K-5054 on March 5, 1936. He flew it for 8 minutes. He came back convinced he had just sat in the most refined aircraft he had ever flown, and he told the ground crew not to touch a thing until he could fly it again. Back at the Supermarine offices in Southampton, R.J. Mitchell heard the report. He was sick. He was in pain. He had been pushing through cancer treatment for years while continuing to work. He had done what he came to do. He died on the 11th June, 1937. He was 42 years old. The Spitfire would not enter Royal Air Force service until 1938. He never saw it wearing squadron roundels. He never heard a pilot call tally-ho over the radio from the cockpit of his airplane. He never knew what it was going to mean. But in the summer of 1940, Britain found out. Germany had swept through France. The evacuation at Dunkirk had gotten the men home but left the equipment on the beaches. The Luftwaffe had air bases now positioned close along the French coast, and they had a mission: destroy the Royal Air Force and clear the sky for an invasion. What followed was the Battle of Britain, running officially from July through October of 1940, with the hardest fighting concentrated in August and September. And during that period, young men, some of them barely 20 years old, were flying 4 and 5 combat sorties a day. They would land, drink tea out of a tin mug while the ground crew refueled and rearmed, and go back up. Mechanics worked through the night patching fabric and changing engines that had been run past their limits. At some stations, they were working by electric torch under blackout conditions and still getting the aircraft back up. The Royal Air Force flew 2 main fighters in that battle. The Hawker Hurricane handled the bulk of the fighting and deserves its own conversation on a different night. But the Spitfire was the aircraft the German pilots feared most. Luftwaffe commanding officers directed their pilots to report any Spitfire engagement specifically. They understood what they were up against. When a Spitfire showed up in your mirror, you were in serious trouble.
Early Mark I Spitfires were powered by the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, making just over 1,000 horsepower, pushing the airplane to around 360 miles per hour. Against the Messerschmitt Bf 109, it was a close-run match. The 109 had an edge in the initial dive, partly because its fuel-injected engine would keep running in negative G where the Merlin would cut out. The Spitfire turned tighter and had the edge at altitude. The outcomes came down to pilot skill, positioning, altitude, and who saw who first. More often than not, the pilot who saw the other one first walked away. There is a detail from that period that often gets overlooked. On the 26th of September, 1940, the Luftwaffe specifically targeted the Supermarine factories at Woolston and Itchen, the plants where the Spitfire was being built. They destroyed both of them, the fuselage jigs, the wing fixtures, the tooling, all of it. Production continued anyway. The Supermarine team dispersed manufacturing to whatever buildings they could find across southern England. Garages, bus depots, a requisitioned laundry, car showrooms. Parts were trucked in and assembled in places that had never seen an aircraft before. Within months, Spitfire production was actually higher than it had been before the raids. Mitchell had built an airplane that could be built under extraordinary circumstances. Partly because the lessons of his racing seaplane program had taught his people how to work fast and improvise under pressure. 77 Spitfire pilots were killed in the Battle of Britain. More than 500 Royal Air Force aircrew died in total. Churchill gave them their monument in words, the ones everybody knows. In the Spitfire squadrons, the pilots used quieter words, the kind traded late at night in mess halls about whoever wasn't there to hear them. And through all of it, those elliptical wings kept flying.
The Spitfire evolved continuously throughout the war in a way that almost no other single aircraft type matched. Mitchell had built something with room to grow.
The Mark V added more Merlin power and cannon armament. The Mark IX, which many pilots considered the best all-around Spitfire of the war, added a two-stage supercharger that made it deadly at high altitude. Later Marks swapped the Merlin entirely for the Rolls-Royce Griffon, a bigger and more powerful engine that pushed top speeds toward 450 miles per hour. Some variants had their wingtips clipped for better low-altitude roll rate. The cockpit canopy evolved from the original framed greenhouse to a blown bubble that gave pilots a clear view in every direction. Photo reconnaissance: Spitfires flew stripped of guns, their gun bays replaced with cameras, penetrating deep into enemy territory at altitudes and speeds that left the interceptors behind. More than 20,000 Spitfires were built across all marks. They served with the Royal Air Force, the Fleet Air Arm, the United States Army Air Forces, and the air forces of more than 30 nations. They flew in the Western Desert, over Malta, in the Pacific, in Italy, across the Rhine, and out to the very end of the war in Europe and beyond. The last operational Spitfire flight by the Royal Air Force was in 1954, 18 years after Mutt Summers landed at Eastleigh and told the ground crew not to touch anything. Today, roughly 240 Spitfires survive in various conditions around the world. Around 60 of them are airworthy. If you've ever had the chance to watch one fly, you understand what I mean when I say it doesn't just move through the air, it flows. And that Merlin sound, that distinctive 12-cylinder voice pulling Britain back from the edge, you do not forget it. Somewhere right now, there's a restoration workshop in Britain where someone is fitting a rib into an elliptical wing section the same way Mitchell's Craftsman did it 8 decades ago, bending sheet metal to a template that a sick engineer refined and signed off on in a drafting room in Southampton before the pain got too bad, before there was any way to know what that airplane was going to be asked to do. Mitchell didn't get to see the battle. He got to see the prototype fly. He heard the first pilot's report, and then he ran out of time. But he did not run out of things to give. My sources today include Alfred Price's book The Spitfire Story, the Royal Air Force Museum, and the National Archives of the United Kingdom. You can find us at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.